Okay, so I want to show you a statistic that I shared with you a few weeks ago, but we want to put it up here so that you can see it and find yourself in it. It's very interesting to me because we hear all sorts of things about how people, you know, are done with religion, they're done with this, they're done with that, and we'll come back to that. But this says a vast majority of U.S. adults report that they would like to grow spiritually. And I think there's a lot to this. First of all, find yourself in the breakouts generationally. And of course, those are all artificial breakouts, but you probably trend or land someplace. But the main thing to notice is that really it's pretty consistent across the board. Almost 3 out of 4 people, no matter what age, they want to grow spiritually. Now, the next thing that we ought to ask is, what does that mean spiritually? Because it's all about the meaning that you pour into the word, spiritual. We hear this, you say this, your friends say this, I'm a spiritual person. Well, what does that mean? And when you want to go further with that, I think we also need to admit that some people, they want to grow spiritually, but man, not with the church, because I got so much baggage with religion, with religious institutions. And I think we should say all of that out loud. So the question then is, how can we make progress spiritually? And for some of you, the question is, how do I walk with somebody who is struggling or seeking or searching through all of that? Today, we're going to jump back into this series that we've been in, and we're going to wrap it up on Mother's Day. So we've just got a few fun things right in a row, and then Mother's Day, and you definitely want to be here for that. But let me just catch you up. This is the rest of our story. If you're just joining us, this is the story we find in the New Testament of how the church grows after Jesus returns to his Father in heaven. We really do think it's the rest of our story. And we've been learning an awful lot, but now let me just catch you up where we are, okay? It's, let's say, AD 48, 49. Paul, this fellow named Paul, you've heard of him, St. Paul, the Apostle Paul. Paul is now on the second of at least 3 missionary trips. He might have taken more, but we know 3 of them. He feels nudged, and we've learned this already, to enter into Europe officially. And so they begin to meet and to plant churches, and they have great success. They have some setbacks. There's a little jail time along the way. It's never boring with Paul. But he gets pushed back in some of these cities. And in fact, not just pushed back, they want to run him out of town. And some people hate him so much that they follow him to the next town, and they want to hassle him there. So we're at that point of the story where his friends, who are not the focus of these agitators, say, Paul, you got to go even further south. Now, they're in Greece. And so they're saying, you need to go down to the next city. We'll drop you off there. We'll come meet you. But you got to lay low and stay out of trouble. That's where we pick things up, because Paul now finds himself in one of the great cities of antiquity, Athens. Now, here's what I want you to do. I'm going to ask you, if you would, to just allow God to stir up your imagination a little bit and put yourself in the story. Allow yourself to see this and to hear this and to what would it be like to be there? Because then God will speak to us through this really, really, really old story. But I need you to know that Athens, great city, had already seen its glory years. Somebody said it was in the autumn of its, but still a great city. The Greek Empire had already been conquered by the Roman Empire, but still a great city. This was the home of Socrates, of Plato, of Aristotle, of Thucydides, of Alexander the Great. For anybody who cares about democracy, it was birthed in the 6th century BC in Athens. I mean, this is some kind of city. And Paul's there. Oh, yeah. By the way, there was so much worship of so many so-called gods in this city that you needed a scorecard to keep up. In fact, there were, by one count, an ancient count, there were well over 25,000 idols, public idols of these gods. And by this count, at least 30,000 private altars in homes around the city. It was a Roman author of that day, Plutonius, who said it was easier to find a god in Athens than a man. So now I want you to picture, you're the Paul, okay? They drop him off, and he's just going to take in the sights. So here's Paul. He's got his Hawaiian shirt and his cargo shorts. Fanny pack. black socks and sandals and his Rick Steves guidebook to Athens. And he's now just walking around, taking it all in. And what Luke tells us, who was one of his associates who just sort of heard all of this story and wrote it down, what Luke tells us, the big, big, big thing that Paul noticed, let's just look at this together in Acts chapter 17. While Paul was waiting for them, those are his friends, in Athens, he was greatly distressed to see that the city was full of idols. So we're going to have to go over some Greek words today, and let's just start with this word distressed. Some of your Bibles will say that he was outraged or angry. You could say that, but it's even more than that. It's the word we get our word paroxysm from. Y'all know what a paroxysm is? It's kind of a, you're so upset, there's like, it's just like a spasm. So Paul sees stuff, and he's just like, this is not right. But I want you to understand something now. If Paul is just upset because these people are not doing the things the way he wants, how do you think he's gonna sound when he finally gets to talk to him? That'd be ugly. If this is all about Paul just proving that he's right and they're wrong, don't you think that his words would have had a real edge to them? What we're going to find is that is not the case at all, that there's actually more to this. Yes, Paul is a Jewish scholar, and Jewish scholars of that day actually memorized the entire Torah. And you're like, well, I don't even think that's physically possible. I can't remember my phone number. I'm telling you, in those days, you had to commit things to memory. And so Paul knows the Torah. He knows the Hebrew scriptures. He knows that there is only one God, and God says it's in the commandments, right? It's in the Big Ten. You shall have no other gods before me. Don't you have any graven images? It's me and only me. Paul knows this. So of course there's that. But I think he also practically sees that this never works. When you chase after these small g gods, they will always disappoint you. So how does Paul now speak to people that are heading in the wrong direction? Well, there you go. I just said wrong, as if there's a right and wrong. And I know for some of us, we need to talk about that. Some of you don't reject Christianity because the evidence isn't there. You are rejecting Christianity because it actually makes truth claims. And I think we should talk about that. In this next series, we're going to talk about that. But if you would allow me, like for now, and we're going to start that right after Mother's Day. But if you'll allow, I want us to talk today about what's it like how do you start to make sense of all of this? And if you're someone who is walking with someone who's in that moment, how do you walk with them? Now again, to understand what Paul's going through, Paul isn't Paul reflects God's heart. If you look at the Greek translation of the Old Testament, that same word distressed is used for God when he sees people chasing after idols. So is God upset? Is there a thunderous rage in the Old Testament when God sees people chasing after idols? Absolutely. But go read the prophets, because there is also a brokenheartedness to God in the book of Jeremiah. It's like, why are you doing this? Come back to me. It's both. That's what Paul is feeling. I think that's really important to say, because honestly, the reason that some of you have backed away from this faith is because somebody somewhere, thinking they were helping, they took a sledgehammer to your life in the name of Jesus. And now you're like, man, if that's the way it works, I'm out. I want you to know there is a different way for us to talk about this. So here we are now. We've set the stage. Here's Paul. How does he open things? We're in verse 17. So he, Paul, reasoned in the synagogue. Now that word reasoned is the word dialegomai. We're almost done with the Greek lessons. But dialegomai is the word that we get our word dialogue from. So Paul's dialoguing with people. In the synagogues, these are people who believe God. These Greek-fearing people are God-fearing Greeks. These are people who are checking out the Hebrew faith. So these are church folk. These are people who believe in the Bible that they have. They have one worldview. Y'all remember that from last week? Really? Sites, are you with me? Does anybody remember this? Okay, one more time. A worldview is how you view The world, yeah, it's not that hard. Okay, so here's the thing. They have one worldview, and then he's talking to people, dialoguing with people in the marketplace, completely different worldview. We might even put it this way. It's the churched and the unchurched. So you start the conversation differently, and we're going to zero in on this unchurched population because that's the story that we find here. So Paul is reasoning with them in the marketplace. Please understand, please. Now we're in the story. Put yourself in the story. This marketplace, do not, as you're imagining things, do not imagine that this is one of those open-air market that you go to when you're visiting another country. This is not, Joe and Susie don't wake up, that morning in Athens and say, honey, I'm going to go pick up some avocados and kumquats because the kids just love those kumquats, so I'm going to go to the marketplace. I don't want you to picture the marketplace like that. Now, you buy goods there, but you need to understand the marketplace, the Greek word was agora. Now, on our app, we've dumped some things for you so that you can look. By the way, did you know that last week we had over 1,400 people hit the app and look at those Easter resources? That's really, really cool. We're going to keep doing that. By the way, those Easter resources are still there. If you go on the app and you hit that, you can keep studying those. But we've now put something on the app where you can look, and they even have like sketches and maps of what it looks like. It'll give you this vision. Just fact check me. It's okay. This is more than what you think of an open-air market. This is the financial center of the city. This is where the big business deals went. I mean, you could make the case. This is kind of like their Wall Street. This is where the big stuff happened. This is where it's like there were massive buildings that would be built off of this hub. This is where the temples were. This is where the political offices, the state offices, the government offices, this is where the seat of government was in the Agora. This was the place where democracy was birthed. This is where the philosophers debated. There were galleries, there were libraries, there were places where you began to see like performance art. This is where, like, if somebody wrote a play, if somebody wrote some music, this is where it happened, was in this big structure. This is where you went to get your news. Somebody even said, so think of this as like the media center, because you would go and there would be heralds and they would be standing like maybe a little bit taller than everybody else on something, and they're the ones that would scream out the latest headlines. This is the heart of the city, and this is where Paul is every day. Now, am I saying that if you're going to follow the example of Paul, that each of you now are going to be like street preachers? No, not saying that. But I am saying that you and I have this opportunity to step into our world and to have these conversations. Everything that so many of us celebrated like from out the soles of our feet last week, if that story is true, then it can't stay in the building. We love this phrase around here, the church has left the building. Well, the good news of Jesus needs to leave the building, and you and I get to put ourselves in positions where, oh boy, I'm now going to have a dialogue with somebody who has a completely different worldview than me. This is how the world still changes. And you and I pray about this, and we enter into this. Gang, we get to learn like Paul did what it's like to ask curious questions and to hear answers that we don't agree with at all. And we're remembering the whole time that the gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ is up to the challenge. Oh, and we get to learn how to speak truth humbly and with love. And that's what's going on with Paul. He's in the marketplace, and this is happening. And Paul loves this. Listen, for those of you who are here and like you're new and you're kind of checking all of this out and you don't really believe in any of this yet, or maybe you do believe and you're wondering, why do y'all do this the way you do it? I want you to know that we take this as one of those places that we want to speak in a way that people understand the biblical truth. We want this to be encouraging. We want it to be challenging. We want it to be creative. We're not afraid to do things in like a winsome way that just kind of gets everybody's attention. That's what these teams are always thinking about. We're going to tell the story that has never changed to this world. But if you're new here, you need to know this is not a place where we edit out the uncomfortable passages. We'll talk about all of it, because as best I can tell, most of us are tired of the spin. And what we want is to hear, like, what do you believe? But we can do it in a humble way. That's what Paul is doing. That's exactly the way it played out in Athens. Now, there were people that were nudging on him. And to be honest with you, there were some people that didn't really like what he was saying. Let's look at this next passage. Put this one up here for us. It says, a group of Epicurean and Stoic philosophers. Don't worry, we're not going into philosophy class here. They began to dispute with him. Some of them asked, what is this babbler trying to say? So now they've resorted to name calling. Some of your Bibles will actually say, instead of babbler, they'll say ignorant show-off. I mean, they just don't think much of Paul at all. Now, the Epicureans are people who are not really even sure that there's a God. There's nothing after this. History's not going anywhere. So eat, drink, and be merry, because then you die. That's the Epicureans. Enjoy life. The Stoics are people who are not really sure that there's a personal God and history's not really going anywhere, but what you really do is you endure life. So their motto is, suck it up, cupcake, and then you die. Neither of them can understand Paul's categories and what Paul is trying to say. They're aggravated, some of them are intrigued, but now they say, you're coming with us to Mars Hill. Now, as soon as I even say those two words, for some of you, it just trips all sorts of things in your mind. Let me help you understand. This Mars Hill was long before a podcast. It was long before a church. Well, how about this? Could we admit out loud that some of you are leery when it comes to the claims of Christ because you have experienced or you have heard about abuses of power in churches? We should talk about that too. In the next series, we're going to open many of these things up. But I want you to understand. I'll use the Greek word for it instead of saying Mars Hill. How about this? Areopagus. That's what it was called. It literally meant the hill of Ares or the hill of Mars, which was the god of war. So I want you to picture now. You still in the story? Paul is going to this place where the famous debaters of the world, the famous philosophers of the world would gather together. The city leaders would gather and hear new ideas. They're taking Paul there. Remember, Paul's supposed to be keeping a low profile. And now Paul is going to speak to what many would call the cultural and intellectual center of the Roman Empire. And what does he say? Well, before we go through that, I want to ask you to turn to some folks around you. And pastors, if you would at the sites, if you would just roam and get some of those answers and ping me, you can use the app, those of you who are joining us online. This is a question that starts arguments in families, so you got that to look forward to. And each of you will have a different definition. You ready? Here it is. I want you to talk to some people around you. What is clutter? Go ahead, talk to each other for a couple of minutes. Okay, we're stirring imaginations. So for some people, clutter is, let me just get one here. It's things that are not in their place. We like things to be in their place. It's too much stuff sitting around collecting dust. Anybody here got anything? Oh, just getting one more here. It's anything out of place? Yeah, so anybody here, what is clutter? It's a lack of discipline. Young man, get back to your room. What else is it? Oh, yeah, so now we're getting personal. We're putting names on it. Okay. All right. All right. Can we just say this? We all have a different definition and a different tolerance for clutter. For some of you, clutter is one paperclip on the desk. And for others at the other end of this spectrum, and I think this is a sad condition, but it's people who the clutter continues to pile on to the place where it smothers your ability to enjoy life. And then if that weren't enough, on top of all of that is a layer of shame. But what I would say is most of us probably land someplace in between those two extremes, okay? Now, here's the thing. Whatever your definition of clutter is, I'm absolutely convinced that the longer you live with clutter, the less you see it. Now, you remember that because we're going to go back into this story. So, Paul is there, and forgive me for this, because honestly, I had ideas for an illustration to help with this that was just, it was high tech, it had talking robots and laser beams, and apparently I blew my budget at Easter, so this is what I get. But I want you to these represent... please notice that I used lowercase. But these represent gods. So there are all of those gods that clutter Athens. Are you with me? Now, what we need to understand here is that Paul sees this. Paul is distressed by this. But then how does Paul, respond to all of this? Does he start off, being all hostile and judgy? Does he just jump in and go, you people are, what are you thinking? Does he vomit up one criticism after another? Does Paul, seeing all of this and knowing that he's got this one chance to talk to, does Paul say, you know what? Y'all got to clear the deck. And now I'm going to talk to you about Jesus. No, that's not what he does. He does what he always did. He starts with where people are. I mean, it's just the most humble, beautiful way to start this. He says, I see that you all are very religious. Now, that word see there, I think this might be the last Greek word I give you, theoreo, it isn't, there were other words that you could just go, I see you're wearing a blue shirt. I see that the sun has come up. This is a different word. I see things beneath the surface. I perceive. Like around here, sometimes we talk about, you see the thing behind the thing. Like there's more to it. And there are some who say that right here, Paul is going, I see all of the art and the culture and the politics and the financial dealings and the clamoring for status and the intellectual pursuits. I see that all of this stuff isn't enough. You're still hungry. So this is what he then says. He says, for I, as I wandered around and looked carefully at your objects of worship, I even found an altar with the inscription to an unknown God. Now what you worship is something unknown, I am going to proclaim to you. I can tell that you're looking for something. In our language today, Paul might say, you know what? I walked around the city and y'all are spiritual. You've got a spiritual hunger. You want to make progress spiritually. And then he comes across, and this is historically accurate, he comes across, there was, centuries earlier, there was they decided that even though they had all of these gods, they were probably missing one. And so to kind of hedge their bets and to be safe, they built an altar, agnos theou, they built an altar to the unknown God. Now, we don't know who it is. There's probably another God out there. We did our best, but we probably should build an altar to the God we haven't met. Paul brilliantly says, hey, can I tell you about him? Because he's the one that changes everything. He's the one that you've been looking for. He's the one that can actually deliver all that you want. And so Paul now, I think in this moment, is doing something that is just so good. You don't have to guess anymore is what he's saying. Now, We're not going to go through the whole sermon, so don't get nervous. It's in Acts chapter 17. In fact, that's not even the whole sermon. It's an outline of the sermon. D.A. Carson says that most of these speeches at the Areopagus would last 2 to 3 hours. And I promise you, Paul was up to that challenge. Like, there's a place later in Acts, maybe we'll get to it, where he goes on in a sermon that was so long that a kid falls asleep in a second-story window, falls out. Well, anyway, that's a different story. I will just tell you that Paul does start with the beginning of the gospel. Now, listen to me. Some of you are early in this journey, and you think the beginning of the gospel is you're a sinner, and Jesus died for you. I want you to hear that's not the beginning of the gospel. The beginning of the gospel sounds like this. In the beginning, God created. You see, you were made for relationship with him, to enjoy each other, to enjoy him, to enjoy life like on this planet. And then in Genesis 3, everything falls apart. Now, these people don't know Genesis, but he still says there's a God who made the world, and he is the Lord of heaven and earth. This is so different from what they had heard. If you know anything about the Greek mythology, the way this worked, their gods were angry, they were unpredictable, they were demanding. And then you start to talk about the creation story. I'm not going to go into it. I'll just tell you, it's chaotic, it's violent, it's incestual, it's disgusting. This is so different. Paul is saying, you want to know how the world was created? By a loving God who's in charge of everything. And he doesn't need anything. He doesn't need anything from you. You can't contain him in your temples. You can't contain him in a little stone statue. He doesn't need anything from you. But I'll tell you what he wants. He wants you to know him. And then these words. He is the giver of life. He is the sustainer of life. He's the one who's put all of this in place so that we seek him and perhaps reach out for him and find him, though he is not far from each one of us. I just think this is the most brilliant way to speak to these people. He says, you don't have to guess anymore. I want to tell you who this unknown God is. He even quotes some of their own poets along the way. Paul knows how to talk to these people. Now, he doesn't back up. Like we said earlier, he gets to a part where he says, you'll have to repent. You'll have to come back. You'll have to turn to this one who died for you and then rose again. Now, here's the thing. Did everybody come to Christ that day? No. Some did, including a really influential man in Athens. So who knows where that went? Some were scoffers. Like, they rolled their eyes at all of this. Because there will always be scoffers. Some of you may not even be ready to talk about a God to whom you need to be accountable. But I'm telling you, God's ready to talk. God's ready to dialogue with you. God's ready to lead you through some of the doubts that you have, and maybe we can talk. But there were some who were curious. They wanted to know more. Does that sound familiar to anyone? Does that sound familiar to anyone you know who's like, I want to be more spiritual, but I can't put my finger on how it works? So the question that we leave here with is, how do we find God in the clutter? Now, gang, I don't think most of us, honestly, I don't think most of us have a world that is cluttered with the temples of Dionysus, or Zeus, or Aphrodite, or Ares. I think most of us have a world that's full of, we're not even gonna say cluttered, but it's a world that's full. And let's not even call them gods, but we've got a lot of demands on our heart. We've got a lot of things that we love. We got a lot of things that we pay attention to. We got a lot of things we want. I want to be financially sound. We like power and control. We like attention. I want a lot of followers on Instagram. I want to be right. I have this career that I'm really committed to. I need to be not just fit, but really fit. I need to be the one who is the most popular. I need to be the one who's got the best looking lawn in the whole stinking neighborhood. I want my house to be like no other. I want my kids to be like the best athletes ever on the planet. I want you, you see how this works? We could keep going. The point is, we could put sex, enjoying alcohol and food. We could put a lot of things up here. Now, what I want you to understand is, I'm not saying, I think most of what I mentioned is inherently, it's not bad. But the question, now, how about this? There are some things that are absolutely destructive and they need to go. So somebody who is addicted to porn and it is destroying their life and their family's life, not to mention what it does as you reach out into society, somebody who has such a desire for control that their anger is abusive, that's just got to come off the table, period. But like most of the things that I'm talking about here, it's like, what do we do with these? Because it's not like God is saying, you got to clear the decks. Well, I think it comes back to what we expect from these things. See, a lot of times we expect so much from these things that they collapse under the weight of it. And there's that one thing that it's just like, not only do I expect so much, I will not let it go. I think about it. I talk about it. It's everything. I cut corners when it comes to other relationships in my life and everything else. And yeah, I know it's causing problems, but I will not surrender this. When we get into that territory, we are in the land of idols. So for any of us, what are we to do in that moment? Like, how do we, I think it comes down to identity. Do we think we're going to get our identity from this role? Like, I'll give you one. It could be our church. It could be our role at church. Pastors, we got to work on this, don't we? All the time. My identity cannot be because of what I do here. It has to be someplace else. It has to be. So what do we do? I'm just going to give this to you, and then we'll head for home. It's this, and it's just two thoughts, okay? It doesn't fix everything. It's two thoughts, and they rhyme, and I'm so proud of that. Well, the first syllables rhyme. So here it is. The first thing is, I just want you to notice what's going on in your life. Notice. And then I want you to know there's a better way. Notice and know. Notice like how you're spending your time. Notice what you expect from these things. Notice whether or not you're really like expecting your whole identity to come from that thing, whatever it is. Notice whether you're clinging to it to the point where it is destroying you. Notice if some of that is happening. Notice, well, how about this? Just ask yourself how it's working. Like, are you satisfied? Notice what it's doing or not doing for your heart. See, even the really fantastic, powerfully good things cannot deliver at the level that we sometimes expect them to. So notice that and then know that there's a better way. See, it's a little bit of what Paul was saying, because when he talks about this unknown God, really, the unknown God isn't an unknown God, is it? By the end of it, he's talking about Jesus. And when you talk about Jesus, what you're really saying is that he rises above all of this. And now Jesus, he doesn't clear the decks and say, yeah, you can't have any of this stuff. What Jesus does is he gives you perspective. Because now you live with grace, and now you live with this idea that you are loved by the God of the universe. Oh yeah, now I don't expect as much from this, but watch how this life flows. You've got more room. He's not going to line this all up in some perfectly regimented way, because our lives are too complicated. But I'm telling you, if you love Jesus, he'll begin to give you perspective on any and all of these things. And now you're a better athlete. Now you're a better student. Now you're a different parent. A different friend, a different artist. You see how that works? A different mechanic, a different scientist. Because Jesus is making you fully alive. So notice, I can't even get my own outline right. I'm so proud of it. Notice what's going on, and then know that there's a better way. You see, because if we get to this place where we really begin to understand that God alone doesn't just redeem you, but pours meaning into your life, this is what you want. And it's not just that you can know God. Here it is. It's that he already knows you. Look, he knows everything about you. He knows your name. He knows the hairs on your head. He knows what you did all those years ago. He knows your dreams. He knows your longings. He knows everything. And when you and I get to a place where we understand that, I'm telling you, it changes stuff. Andy Crouch, my friend, has written his next brilliant book. It's entitled The Life We're Longing For. And in it, he maps out this longing that we have for relationships in a technologically cluttered world. Now, his point is different from mine, but I just want to give him the credit for this, because as I started to read even the opening pages of his book, it just brought me back to stuff that I used to study before I became a pastor. You see, there was a pretty famous study that was done back in the mid-70s by a researcher named Edward Tronick. And some of you will know by the name of the experiment, but he put this out there then and has been building on it ever since. It's called the Still Face Experiment. Anybody ever heard of that? Here it is. And when you study these things, I'm just going to warn you, even if you look at one of the videotapes of these experiments, it breaks my heart. Now, they only last 2 minutes long, so there's no permanent anything done. But in those 2 minutes, you've got a little one-year-old, and she's sitting in a chair, and her mom or her dad or her caregiver is right there in front of them doing what moms always do, loving, playing, giggling, and that little one is interacting with mom and learning how to make their way in the world, right? And so they're giggling and they're smiling and they're doing all that they do and they're pointing and they're laughing and mom is just being a mom and just all of that, right? And then the experiment begins and mom turns away and then she turns back. It's not an angry face. It's what he calls a still face. It doesn't respond. And I'm telling you, when you watch it, within 5 seconds, that little one has reacted and gone. So what she does first is she does all of her tricks. Well, I'm gonna laugh, I'm gonna cry, I'm gonna giggle, I'm gonna clap. These are all the things that get mommy's attention. I'm gonna point, I'm gonna this. And now she starts getting upset and now she gets quiet. And maybe she does this. But by the end of most of these videotapes, when you watch them, that little one is twisting and writhing in distress. It's like, this isn't right. 2 minutes, I'm telling you, 2 minutes. And then mommy comes back. It's like, no, I'm right here, sweetheart. And everything's good. For those of you who are parents, new parents, gonna be parents, you are probably aware that in an ordinary delivery, there comes a moment, usually pretty close to delivery, and you have it for about an hour, and it's a state that the experts call quiet alert. In the state of quiet alert, and it happened with both of my girls, you have this little one. The breathing is calm. The body is not moving much. Those impossibly big eyes are searching and looking to focus on something that's like 8-12 inches away. Andy writes these words. They're looking for a face, and when they find one, especially a face that gazes back at them, they fix their eyes on it, having found what they were most urgently looking for. Do you know what he says the first quest of humanity is? Recognition. I just want somebody to see me. I just want somebody to recognize me as a person in this world. Now, friends, as I began to think about that and to go over that, he's making his own brilliant points, and please, just go enjoy it. But I will just tell you, as I read that, I began to think not only of the way you and I need each other. That's why we gather here on the weekends. That's why we need to see each other and hear each other, because there is a physicality to it, and we need to know and be known. God has made us this way. But when I think about that experiment, when I think about that ache, when I think about that longing, when I think about all of the time that we spend chasing after so many things, I began to wonder, is it still that? Are we still longing to be recognized? Are we still wanting to know that we exist and that we matter? And maybe more than anything, as we chase after all of these other things, are we wanting to know that we know that we know that we are seen and recognized by the God who created us? You see, I think that's the longing that people have when they say, I just want to grow spiritually. You know what you want? You want to know that God knows you. And I think it is not by accident that one of the early names of God in Genesis, in the Hebrew, is El Roi, the God who sees. He is the God who sees me. He is the God who sees you. I want you to know, as you start to sift through this, wherever you are on your journey, I want you to know that there's a God who knows you, and he knows you by name. There's a God who has a plan for you. There's a God who loves you so much that he paid everything to make a way for you. And if that's really true, like if that's really true, like Jesus really happened, then what are we supposed to do? How about this? Seek him and perhaps reach out for him and find him, though he is not far from each one of us. If you're a scoffer, there are people in these rooms that have had the same questions you've had. If you're someone who's wanting to know more, there are people who will walk with you right now. And if you are a believer in Jesus, do not ever forget that this God loves you that much, okay? We'll see you next week. We're going to keep this story going. Thank you for being here.